move to the last case for today, which is United States versus Donaby. Dorman?
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning.
With the court, board. This is a situation where I think that Mr. Donaby didn't get a fair shake based upon his attorney's behavior.
Can I ask you, though, Mr. Storman, you're raising at this point ineffective assistance of counsel, and unlike some cases, here we have some information about what Mr. Herman did, but I, for example, don't really have a very good feel of why he chose not to call the alibi witnesses. He was in an awkward position, I believe, when he was asked about this at the trial because of attorney-client concerns, and he quite rightly tried to be circumspect in that situation. If he saved this issue for a 2255, we would know if he decided not to call those alibi witnesses because they themselves seemed extremely unreliable or, you know, whatever reasons one might have for not choosing to call witnesses. It seems like they might have supported this defense theory that he had, that he wasn't really there at the robbery. He only came later and he was trying to get rid of this stolen car. So is this something he really wants to raise right now?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the best way to answer your question is he believes that the evidence before this court at this particular point is sufficient, and basically he wants to get out of jail.
Oh, I don't doubt
that. I'm stating sort of the obvious. But I think that, you know, and
but this is not a no investigation case. Even the alibi witnesses themselves in their affidavits acknowledged that there was contact with them from the defense lawyer.
Well,
and Mr. Herman also indicates in court a couple of times that he had his investigator talking to them. So it's hard to put it in the box of these extreme cases where the lawyer did absolutely nothing, and that's not good.
I would disagree to some extent, and what you just stated was basically what the government's position or what the government's reading of these affidavits were. The affidavits were that a fair reading of that is, and I was not the counsel at trial, so I can't necessarily say this, but I mean a fair reading of the affidavits say that they approached the trial lawyer and said, "We're here," and the trial lawyer says, "Well, go home. We don't need you."
Well,
now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he knew what they were going to say.
It says, I was informed by the defendant's former counsel that I was not needed at the time of trial. So
I mean,
at least there's a conversation. I mean, I don't know how long that conversation was. Once again, getting to my earlier point about our ability to give this a fair shake as an argument.
Well, I mean, I think that
you need to make a decision standing here to tell us whether or not you want to pursue the ineffectiveness claim on direct appeal, given that all we've got in the record concerning the alibi defense is the affidavit.
I mean, he doesn't lose it if you don't. It just goes over to a 2255, which he doesn't understand. I'm sure you do.
Well, as I said, this is a situation where, my client feels that he really got the short end of the stick, and that, and I would draw the court's attention and to conversations that were had between my client and the court the day before, the first day of trial. I mean, my client, who's sitting there ready for trial and got the jury and panel, he stands up and starts on this tirade of, "My lawyer has not done anything for me." And I think, and I don't mean to digress too much, but I think it factors into this point that at the end of the first day of trial,
These are all arguments that can be made in a 2255.
Okay. Well,
but it's your decision, of course.
I understand. Well, what I would do is, I think the court, well, at least I hope the court understands the position that we're drawing. I think that, you know, my client has asked me to bring these issues to the court, and that he feels that, and as do I, that there is enough record at this point, especially in light of
the we do have a little bit more because of the affidavit filed by the government, in which Mr. Bruce asserts that in any case the decision not to call alibi witnesses is made for tactical reasons based upon my knowledge of the evidence and my experience as a trial attorney. We have things like that. You do have that in
mind. Right. Well, I think that, as I said,
counsel's remarks were not under oath.
Well, and that's true.
By affidavit, I guess.
Right.
And
to some extent, without beating up unnecessarily on Mr. Herman, I mean, I think to some extent that the statements that he made, which are included in the government's brief, were a little bit self-serving. I think that, you know, we ended with, "Your Honor, I've practiced in your court long enough to know that I know what I'm supposed to be doing, and then I'm going to be," you know, I mean, it's a little bit self-serving. And
then Judge Steele says all these things about what a great lawyer Mr. Herman is, which is a little troubling.
Well, but, you know, the other thing, too, and I'm going to kind of jump back a little bit. You know, on the first day of trial, it's that, you know, my client stands up and says, you know, "My gosh, this is terrible. I'm not getting any sort of defense."
Mr. Storman, you only have a very limited amount of time.
I understand.
And you have a decision to make, and you should, you know, make it and then go on to your next argument.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'm going to stand on my first point, at least at this point, because I think that, I do not think that raising this issue is going to necessarily hasten him out of a 2255 in the future.
If you persist in it and we rule on it, that's the end of it. You won't have a 2255 to follow up on.
Okay. Well, then I stand corrected.
On this issue, it's just you don't raise in 2255 issues that have been resolved on the direct appeal.
Well, Your Honors, then, I think it might be a wiser decision in light of comments made that we would withdraw that particular issue and save it for a 2255. And hopefully I don't get a 2255 on myself because I'm doing that.
Well, just delay it.
I'm joking.
Just delay it for a little while. Not yours, but his.
Well, then, what I will do then is I will scoot ahead. The issue too that was raised in my brief is really not one that I would wish to argue. I think I would just stand on the arguments that were made in the brief and scoot on to something I think was more appropriate for argument. The question of including the van in the assessment for sentencing. This is a situation where I think that the Austin case, which was cited, is directly on point. Now, you know, although it is in a different circuit, it is, I think, directly on point, and I am not aware of any other decision in this circuit that would defeat that.
Are you on the van or the police car?
Okay, I'm on the van. The van. Yeah, it's on the van issue. The police car. Police car issue, I think, stands on its own.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
So I'm going to talk about the van. U.S. versus Austin, I think, is directly on point and rules against the district court on the issue. Now, the government, in its brief, talks about the fact that, it should be plain error on this issue. I don't know that even if it is a plain error.
But isn't there already a didn't the Eighth Circuit decide that in a similar situation a stolen getaway car could be included? So we have already a conflict in the circuits on this point, right?
Right.
Okay.
The point being, though, is I think that the reasoning in Austin, I think, is a wiser decision, is a wiser way to go about this thing. And to say the plain error completely aces my client out on this, I think is not necessarily the case. You know, we do have a question of stare decisis. We do have a question of that it has been decided in the way that we're asking the court to decide this case. And I think that the analysis in Austin is a much wiser way to go with this thing, because there is a distinct break in time or in criminality, or however you want to phrase it, between when the van was stolen. Some days later, it was then, you know, the armed robberies were committed. I think just to kind of throw it all in is one situation, especially in the light of the fact that there's no question about the fact that my client had a long history of car theft. You know, is misappropriately decide this particular issue. So I would ask the court to follow Austin. And
you want to talk about the police car?
Well, the police car issue, I think, as I said a minute ago, I think that issue is pretty well dealt with in the brief. I don't want to necessarily talk about this. I would stand on the issue in the brief.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd.
Welcome back, Mr. Lloyd.
Thank you. When I got my second notice that I was going to be up here, I thought that perhaps I was being picked on. Plus the fact that I've written 5 briefs this summer.
Oh.
Your Honor, it's the position of the government that this case should be affirmed. The evidence in this case was substantial. There was no violation of the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights. His counsel was not ineffective. In fact, looking at one of the pages in the brief and the conclusion of the defendant's first argument, he mentioned the fact that counsel's cross-examination was more than adequate.
I think that Mr. Stormont had decided only to withdraw that.
Yeah.
The issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. So that's probably not before.
And since the defendant did not raise the sufficiency of the evidence argument in this case, looking at the second argument, the Austin case, it's the government's position that the correct standard of review in this case is plain error. There are no cases on this issue in the circuit. Since the circuit has not established a point of view on this issue, it would be hard to say that the ruling by the district court would be plain error, because there's no standard on that issue. In fact, the second counsel, Mr. Mack, very vehemently argued during the sentencing hearing that the standard should be the wholesale value rather than the market value, and then later on he talked in terms of replacement value. So all during the sentencing hearing, the defense counsel who represented Mr. Donaby felt that there should be some value placed upon the van. So we're not talking of a situation of a...
Forgive me. I breathed.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's the government's position that under Guidelines 2B3.1, Application Note 3, which defines loss, means the value of the property taken, damaged, or destroyed, leads us to relevant conduct under Guidelines 1B1.3, the loss amount calculated as a harm resulting from all acts of the defendant during commission in preparation or in course of trying to avoid detection or responsibility.
I guess it doesn't matter then which loss calculation is used, whether it's the depreciated value of the van or the repair value or the wholesale value or any of the rest of that at this stage?
I think based upon my experience during that sentencing hearing, I think the court was right in applying the damages to the van, since the van was ultimately recovered.
In other words, the repair.
The repair cost.
The question that I have, though, and I do have a question, is about the damaged police vehicle, because when you look at Huey, it limits restitution to the loss caused by the specific conduct that is the basis of the offense of conviction. And I agree that the chase has a substantial connection with the robbery itself, but does it meet the Huey test? In other words, does the specific conduct that is the basis for the robbery conviction include the high-speed pursuit that occurred after the robbery?
Yeah, and I believe that the high-speed chase was something that was contemplated by Defendant Donovan and the other defendants, not using one of the known vehicles, but Mr. Tyrone Wingate had a vehicle that was owned by a member of the family. Joe Wingate had a vehicle that was owned by the family, but they chose to use the vehicle that was stolen for the high speed chase, for the to go to the bank and for purposes of leaving the bank.
Well, would that matter as to which vehicle damaged the police vehicle? It's the police vehicle I'm talking about now.
Yeah, I would say to the court that the damage to the vehicle were foreseeable.
So you're basically saying fleeing from a bank robbery is all part of the bank robbery, and thus damage is inflicted in the effort to get away, in your view, are encompassed?
That's what I would say to Your Honor. I believe that an armed bank robbery provides for foreseeable results, meaning an armed police chase at high speed to protect other citizens. I think that's foreseeable in the use of a weapon and going into a bank and robbing the customers and the employees.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd. Mr. Dormant, did you have anything else you wanted to add? How much time? Well, thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.